All right. Well, I hope you had a chance to listen to part one of this week's Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast. It featured an interview with Iowa City Liberty standout runner Ashlyn Keeney. And now this is part two. It's a conversation with Keenan Crow of One Iowa.
Listen to the Ankeny Fanatic Weekly Podcast, sponsored by Coldwell Banker MidAmerica. Gershman Mortgage is also a sponsor of the podcast. Gershman, the Midwest's premier mortgage lender, is proud to be part of the Ankeny Fanatic Podcast. Whether you're looking to purchase a new home, vacation home, upgrade, or remodel an existing home, or refinance your current mortgage, Gershman Mortgage is here to help. With over 60 years in the mortgage industry, we have security, experience, and unmatched service. You can visit their Ankeny office, call 515-964-5952, or visit Gershman.com to get pre-approved today. Well, my next guest is the Director of Policy and Advocacy at One Iowa, an organization that seeks to improve the lives of LGBTQ Iowans by protecting and advancing equality and inclusiveness through education, improving workplace culture, and increasing access to quality health care across our state. So welcome to the podcast, Keenan Crow. How are you?
I'm pretty decent. Yourself?
Hey, I'm doing good. It's been kind of a long day. I explained that earlier on my opening monologue, so we don't need to go into that. But well, anyway, Keenan, we haven't talked before recording this podcast, but I have a pretty good idea what your opinions are going to be on this issue just because of your position at One Iowa. But
well, I'll be able to guess.
But I'll let you speak for yourself. Okay. What was your reaction when you first heard about this bill that would ban transgender girls from competing in girls' sports, and then your reaction when it recently was signed into law?
Sure. Well, that's a hard question to answer, because I think the first time we actually heard of it was when Kim Reynolds last year went on Fox News and said that she was going to call for this, and we had not heard anybody talking about it before that point. So we kind of waited for that session to materialize, and we did a whole lot of background work while we were waiting, and it didn't turn up last year, fortunately. But this year, obviously it did. And once it was introduced, it moved at an extremely rapid pace, faster than almost anything I've ever worked on before, which made it very, very hard to actually get competent information in front of the people who are making these decisions, which to some extent seemed like that it was intentional, right? Like,
right.
They're in charge of the scheduling in the first place. So, I think when the bill was introduced, the time that it was out of a subcommittee, we had about 14 hours, maybe.
Wow.
Which, if you have to imagine, a lot of the things that we're doing in the background while this is happening are making sure that we can get experts to testify, making sure that we can get impacted athletes and their parents into the room, mental health professionals, doctors, you know, you name it. And that requires within, 14 hours, getting them to drop what they were doing that day, travel across the state, potentially. The athlete that was at all the subcommittees lived in the Decorah area. And so we had that bill introduced maybe at, 2-3 o'clock. On a Wednesday, and then it was slated for a subcommittee at 7 a.m. the following day. So getting them to drop everything they were doing and get up at 3-4 in the morning to come travel to Des Moines just
right.
to talk about how it was going to impact their lives. I mean, that's not it's not an easy ask, and it's not a good way to legislate either, to be completely honest. That's been one of my bigger frustrations that, we often did get into in the press because there were more pressing things to talk about when it came to this bill. But in longer formats, I think there's something to be said about, having enough time to actually figure out what's going on with some of this stuff. Because if you listen to the actual subcommittee, all of the experts and people with scientific backgrounds and, folks who were directly impacted, they were all on the same side. And it wasn't the side that prevailed, and
right.
that's always, a very concerning thing.
Well, and you probably have a lot more knowledge about this than I do, and I don't have any numbers to support this claim. I tried to get some information from the Girls Union about the number of transgender girls who were currently competing in girls' sports, but I was unsuccessful. But I just can't imagine that there are that many transgender girls who are dominating girls' sports and who will now be affected by this new law. Do you kind of feel like, this law is a solution for a problem that doesn't exist?
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. We know of about a handful, all the ones that we know about are not really in any competitive capacity to speak of. They're on junior varsity teams. They're, you know, they're basically just participating. They're not winning medals or scholarships or anything like that. And so it's hard to imagine a problem that it actually solved. And the other thing that I'll interject into that is that this bill applies from kindergarten through college.
Right.
And so if folks think that there's a problem with you know, people in kindergarten having some sort of athletic advantage, I think maybe they need to do some soul searching on
right.
And I didn't mention this in my opening monologue. I know there are some extreme isolated cases, like the swimmer at Penn, who was really good, who was dominating the women once she made the transition. And I get that people who are competing against her, maybe they feel like that's unfair.
Sure.
And I didn't say this either in my opening monologue, but, you know, there are some cisgender girls out there who are a lot more muscular and strong than just other girls and who might dominate. And, you know, is that fair? That's how they were born, you know?
So. Right. I think when we're looking at issues of unfairness, we have to not look at a couple isolated incidents. We're really looking at, like, population-wide levels, right? So it's hard to actually pin down how many transgender people there are, but in terms of, you know, what percentage of the population do transgender women make up? Yeah, probably just about 1%-ish, depending on what kind of estimates you're using and how inclusive you're making that term. It's a long story, but, you know, let's ballpark it at like 1%, just to be safe, and then let's look at, well, if everything's fair, they should be winning roughly 1% of the titles, getting 1% of the scholarships, you know, having 1% of the medals. That's not what's happening. It's not even close to that percentage, right? We have one example out of thousands and thousands and thousands of college athletes in all sorts of different games. Transgender people have been able to compete in the Olympics for a substantial amount of time, well over a decade. I can't remember the exact year. But you'd think if the fears were warranted that they would have all sorts of medals, and only one transgender woman has ever qualified for the Olympics ever, let alone, I mean, didn't even come close to placing, DQ'd herself in kind of the first round. So the evidence is lacking, to say the least. But with this policy, we don't even have to get there is the thing. This is a blanket ban, right? It doesn't take into account our scientific understandings of this issue. It doesn't take into account any sort of research-based evidence or anything. It's a political tool, and therefore it's a very blunt tool at that, because it again is a categorical across-the-board ban. It does not take into account any sort of differences like that, and it really equates kind of one-to-one cisgender men with transgender women, and we know that is just not an accurate comparison.
Well, it seems like there should be some room for just common sense. I mean, I explained this in my opening monologue that, you know, my transgender son, he started to make the transition when he was a freshman, mm-hmm. female to male, just started it, but he actually played on the girls' soccer team because he wasn't very good, wasn't very athletic, and he there's no way he could have played with the boys. So at that point, you know, if he was going to play, he needed to play with the girls, and nobody cared. I mean, it was just common sense. He played on the JV freshman team or whatever it is. And, I mean, it worked out. He had fun. They accepted him. End of story. I mean, you know, you can kind of correlate that to what's going on now. And today, somebody probably would complain that, well, hey, he's on testosterone shots. Maybe he shouldn't play with the girls. It didn't make a difference.
Well, those are the kind of nuanced arguments that we would be having if we had a policy that was actually fair and inclusive. We would have to look at some of these cases that are maybe closer to something that we might, you know, want to legislate about or might want to make a policy about. I tend to think the best policy is kind of a case-by-case evaluation, just because there are, you know, kids that are at different points in their transitions that are kids who, you know, might be unsafe in certain situations, or maybe the dress code is impeding their ability to compete on a certain team because their body is developed in a certain way, and that's restricting. You know, there are all sorts of tough cases, and that's why the case-by-case system seems to work really well, is because that actually allows you to look at the context surrounding the situation rather than putting out this blanket kind of one-size-fits-all policy.
Yeah, because it's not black and white, is it?
No, it's not. It's very much not. And especially when we're talking about young people, I think the conversation really has to be like, how can we maximize participation? Because we know that there are all these benefits from sport. Very few kids get scholarships, right? Very few kids, was like 99% of kids that do sports are not going to go on and play at the college level.
Exactly.
And then a substantial portion of those folks are not going to get scholarships. A substantial portion of those folks are never going to go on to play pro, et cetera. So really what we should be looking at is how can we safely let everybody participate? That probably should be our number one goal rather than allocation of scholarships, because that's really not what 99% of kids are there for. 99% of kids are there because for fairly mundane reasons. Maybe it was this or piano, right? Or something like that. But a lot of them are there just because they want to have fun with their friends, or they want to get some more exercise, or they want to build a skill, or they want to, for some kids, feel like part of something greater than themselves, which is a lot of what you get when you play on a team. You feel like something a little bit more important than just you, which in a lot of ways can kind of be an antidote against some of the invidious discrimination that these folks are facing over and over and over again, because that actually builds community for them. And we know that community is often the things that makes people more resilient to those kinds of tough experiences.
Well, yeah, I was just going to ask you, before we get into the high school sports aspect, of this new law, can you just talk about the transgender kids in general and all the hurdles that they face when they are going through their transition? Because, these kids really are at risk for things like discrimination and harassment.
Sure. Yeah. It's still a real tough thing to be a transgender young person. It's a tough thing to be a transgender person, period. But imagine where you were at in maybe middle school or high school. I was a very insecure young person. I'm sure many of our listeners were as well. It's being a young person isn't super easy. It gets kind of harder as time goes by and the world gets more complex and harder to understand and harder to figure out where you yourself fit, right? And it's even harder when there's something like gender dysphoria thrown into the mix, and then you have to deal with that and thoughts about how that makes you fit in, and thoughts about your body, and thoughts about all sorts of complex things that are kind of tough to describe. If you've never met a transgender person, it's tough to maybe understand what it's like to be transgender, and people try to kind of pigeonhole it into their own experiences and think, well, if I was, if I felt this way, how would I navigate that? And at the abstract level, it may seem like something that's doable, but I don't think people necessarily understand kind of how pervasive the discrimination is. That's maybe the one thing that it's tough to envision, not only how much of it there is, but like how it can make you feel. And especially, kids that are misgendered kind of on a regular basis, it gets to be very disorienting, because you get into this situation where it starts to become very apparent that the way you see yourself is not how the majority of other people see you. And that is tough to describe if you've never been there before. It makes you question a lot, not just about yourself, but about the world in general, and again, kind of your position in it. But in a profoundly, sometimes dreadful way. And so that's maybe what I would encourage people to think about, is how would that kind of stuff feel, and also understand that the discrimination is probably a lot worse than you're imagining it. As somebody who's non-binary and doesn't necessarily get the same types of discrimination that maybe a binary trans person would feel, I know how it feels to be misgendered. I know how how very gendered our society can be, from going to the doctor and, you know, filling out the form there and making sure that you have the right insurance coverage and all that stuff. I mean, just that example, about one in five trans people in the U.S. reports having been outright denied medical care just because they're transgender, right? You walk into the doctor, they figure out you're transgender, they say, I'm not going to treat you, no matter what it is. That's 20% of transgender people. That's a substantial amount. And that's kind of an extreme example, but you can envision maybe if there's that many people that are willing to outright deny medical care to trans folks, what are some of the maybe lower levels of discrimination these folks are facing, and how frequent that must be compared to the frequency of something that's much more severe? Because we know that the discrimination kind of happens on a continuum, and if there's no intervention, you know, it gets more and more substantial as things move along. So it's kind of everywhere, from employment to housing to interactions with law enforcement or corrections. I mean, if you look at kind of every different measure we have around societal well-being, you're going to find that transgender people are disproportionately worse off at pretty much every one of those metrics. And so to be in that group is to be discriminated against at a regular clip. And to the extent that you can kind of minimize that and create a community for yourself, it makes that a lot better. But you can't avoid all of it. It's impossible. It's so pervasive and so ongoing that it's really hard to avoid. So, you know, imagine that you're a kid already in this situation, and now you have the legislature telling you can't bowl with your friends. Well, what kind of sense does that make, right? It's baffling to be a young person in the first place, and then to have the government of your state saying, well, no, we're going to make this so that you're discriminated against legally. That's kind of an extra blow.
Well, I can't imagine what that does to a kid's self-esteem.
Having the government target a group that you belong to, period, for differential treatment is not a terribly fun experience. But being a young person, it amplifies that, because you don't necessarily know kind of what even to do with that information, right? Like, a lot of these kids are too young to even vote. It's hard to find a path forward in those situations, especially for young folks. But it's hard to find a path forward for a lot of folks. It's just even harder when you're younger, and it doesn't totally make sense.
For sure. Well, you talk about how people, if they don't know a transgender person, how they just may not know, understand how they feel or what they're all about. And trust me, as somebody who has a son who's transgender, I mean, he started transitioning 10 years ago. I learned something new every day that I talk to him. I mean, that I just hadn't thought about, or just I'm learning things constantly. And you can't imagine. Unless you know somebody who's gone through it, you don't know what it's like. But and you talked about, you know, what it's like for a person to be denied the opportunity to play the sport that they love. Well, conversely, if a transgender girl is allowed to compete in a sport that she enjoys playing, you know, how beneficial do you think that can be for the individuals they try to become, you know, the person that they were meant to be?
Yeah, it's extremely beneficial. As I was saying earlier, it confers a number of different skills, not just physical skills, which I think it obviously confers, but there's also a lot of mental skills. There's leadership skills that are involved. There's, you know, the skill of being on a team in the first place, and maybe not even leading it, but just being a team player. That's a skill in and of itself, and learning that kind of humility and learning to work as a group rather than as a solo unit. That's a skill. You know, there are social benefits to it. There are physical benefits to it. There are inter-peer benefits to it. It's kind of good across the board to get kids participating in sports. And again, that's why I say we should be kind of leaning into that participation aspect, trying to get more kids in sports, trying to get more kids doing physical activities rather than less. To the extent that it prevents kids from doing that, I think that's a negative, not just for the trans kids, but it's a negative kind of for sport overall and for our schools. And it's very disruptive too, right? Like when a school is going to treat a transgender girl as a girl from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. or whatever, but as soon as 4 p.m. rolls around and they're on the sports team, oh, we've decided that we're going to change that entirely. That's really disruptive. It's disruptive to the other kids. It's disruptive to the student. It's disruptive to the school's policy of treating everybody equally and not discriminating. And now they're being kind of forced by law to do that. So it's, the benefits are immense. The downsides are immense to not letting people have that. And so I fail to see how this is a net good for anybody. I really fail to see how it helps anybody in the first place. But I think the detrimental impacts are substantial and easily illustrated.
Now, I've heard some people make the argument, you know, that without this law, we're going to have all these boys deciding to transition so that they can compete against girls and win all these medals. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, that's absurd. So it was already the case in Iowa under the Iowa Athletic Associations that in order to participate, you had to kind of essentially have socially transitioned, right? So if you are living as that gender at home, at school, at church, everywhere else in your life, not just at sports practice. And so to imagine somebody upending their lives just to get a trophy or something or be on the high school record holder list, I mean, that's kind of small potatoes. Sure, how disruptive it's going to be to your, because it is going to be immensely disruptive to somebody's life. If they're not really transgender, that's going to induce some gender dysphoria for them too. And I'm not sure that folks are necessarily understanding of how psychologically substantial that would be for that person. I mean, like, transgender people have to deal with it. Cisgender people generally don't. But if a cisgender person put themselves in that situation, they would have to deal with it. And it probably would not be a very fun experience, and certainly not worth whatever they were getting out of it, even if it was a scholarship or something. I mean, it's to know transgender folks and to know what they have gone through and to see the kind of pervasive discrimination they deal with. Nobody would do that. It's right. Just it's an absurdity. Maybe the most absurd argument about this bill is that one. And there are a lot of absurd things about this bill. So that's really setting a quite a high bar. But that is absolutely categorically not going to happen in any way, shape, or form. And if it does, I would be shocked. And if that kid is psychologically okay afterward, I would be doubly shocked.
Well, if there is a case out there, I'd like somebody to present it to us.
Well, and I don't think there is. I mean, maybe they have an example of somebody who played a game or something as a girl and they got away with it because nobody knew better or didn't go to that school or, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe they can find some weird isolated example, but they're not going to find anybody who is living as a transgender person exclusively to play sports. That is just very silly to me.
Well, I know there have been a number of school districts in Iowa that have, you know, tweeted out their support for the LGBTQ community in response to this new law.
Sure.
There have also been some students who have walked out of school in protest of the law. Mm-hmm. You know, do you think there's any chance that the law could be repealed if there's enough backlash to it?
No. I have to be real honest with you. I don't think so. And the reason is because the backlash to it during the process was substantial as well. And that did not seem to deter anybody. The evidence was substantial, and that did not seem to deter anybody. Again, this definitely seems like a political move more than a deft policy move, right? It's not intended to actually accomplish policy goals. It is intended to win votes, essentially.
So it's not something that's going to make the lives of all Iowans better, huh?
No. Again, I can't think of anybody whose life it's actually going to improve because, you know, nobody was losing anything to transgender girls in the first place. So hard to illustrate how that is going to make anybody's life better off. Easy to illustrate whose life it's going to make worse.
Well, I guess one of my concerns is that, you know, today we're trying to prohibit transgender girls from competing in girls' sports, you know, but where is this going to lead? You look around the country and there's just a slew of bills being introduced that could limit the rights of LGBTQ Americans. You know, and frankly, it's frightening. The proposals range from prohibiting instruction about gender identity in the classroom to restricting access to gender-affirming health care, which you touched on. And in some states like Idaho, the bills are even more extreme. Last week, their state house approved the bill that would stipulates medical personnel who provide gender-affirming health care and parents who agree for their child to receive such care could face life in prison. You know, wow, I don't even know where to begin with that. I guess, you know, it's good that my family doesn't live in Idaho because my wife and I, you know, would be in danger of being locked up.
Yeah. We've seen over and over again that these athletics bills are really the tip of the spear in the same way that a lot of legal cases were using wedding cakes or wedding photography as kind of the tip of the spear for anti-marriage equality work. The trans athletics bans are really the tip of the spear for this kind of anti-trans legislation, which has been absolutely exploding in the past couple of years, not just in Iowa, but in Iowa it is as well. We had at the end of the first funnel, 28 active LGBTQ or anti-LGBTQ bills in the Iowa State House, 19 of which were anti-trans. If you look at kind of nationwide, what the breakdown looks like, if you like in state legislatures across the country, there's about 35 anti-trans bills in 2019. That number goes up to 100 in 2020. Then it increases even more to over 180 in 2021. I'm not sure where we're at right now in 2022, because state houses move rather rapidly in the early parts of the year, so I don't have a good count then, but I imagine we're even higher than that. Some of the bills that you mentioned, Iowa had introduced already. They didn't get anywhere. Unfortunately, we were able to kill off a lot of them in that first funnel action, but we had introduced a ban on medical care. We had introduced kind of one of those don't say gay, don't say trans type bills like there was in, or there is in Florida right now, actively being debated. Representative Jeff Shipley, who said some really terrible comments during the House debate and essentially compared transgender youth to cancer spreading, which was abhorrent, he came out kind of a couple days after the bill had passed and said, great, that's step one. Now step two is let's look at these don't say gay type bills. Let's look at the healthcare bans, etc. So there is a kind of a well-known progression, and the athletics ban is the foot in the door, but we know where this goes from here. And so we'll be working really hard to stop that. We obviously can't do it alone. And so we need folks to help push back against those things, because we don't want to get into a situation. I mean, Idaho's is a particularly bad example, but Texas right now is, terrorizing families of transgender young people with Ken Paxton's order essentially equating gender-affirming care to child abuse and having child abuse agencies look into parents who are providing gender-affirming care. Now, it was stayed as of Friday, but there for a week or two, I mean, these kids were, and their families were trying to figure out how to relocate. They were trying to figure out, you know, all sorts of things. The main plaintiff is actually works for DFPS, which is the entity that looks into child abuse. And so she was put on administrative leave and is in danger of losing her job. The other thing to think about with that is the impact on healthcare professionals. I mean, they're in a really no-win situation, right, where they are put in a place where they either follow their ethical duty to provide care that is safe, effective, and necessary, and to provide it confidentially, and their now legal duty from the state of Texas, which is telling them to do
the exact opposite of all those things.
Right.
And so they can either follow state law or they can follow the guidance from their licensing board, but they can't really do both. And that's a really tough spot to be put in as well. So it's not just, again, I want to kind of maybe broaden the impact on this, because I think a lot of folks just think of it in terms of, well, how is this going to impact trans kids and their families, which I think is good, and we should center those folks, but it has these broader negative impacts on a lot of other people as well. And so I want to keep that in mind as we move forward and as some of these ideas become more popular in Iowa, to make sure that people are kind of keeping their eyes on the prize here and not just thinking like, oh, this isn't going to impact me. Well, it will. It's just a question of how, because it's not just going to be trans kids and their families. It's also going to be, there are going to be economic stakes here. We may not get the same kinds of tournaments, events, et cetera, that we've had in the past because of things like this. There are going to be folks who don't want to relocate to Iowa because they have trans kids that maybe want to play sports, or maybe they want to leave the option open in the future for them to play sports, etc. There are also, we have pretty good research to demonstrate that, like, for instance, when kids are looking at colleges, one of the things that they kind of use as a ballpark for how colleges treat creative thinkers or people who are maybe different in some way from the community they're moving into is they use policies about how they treat LGBTQ folks as a proxy for those things, because sometimes those policies are easier to find or more visible. And so kids are going to be choosing not to come to college in Iowa because of things like this. Businesses are maybe going to think twice about relocating their centers into Iowa. I mean, again, we're having a workforce crisis right now where there are more folks there are more job openings than there are folks on unemployment already. And so we need more folks to come to this state if we're going to remain competitive in any way, shape, or form. And bills like this arbitrarily exclude a portion of the population that may otherwise want that job and be really skilled for it, and that's not a good decision economically either. So the impacts are almost innumerable, and again, this is going to make Iowa a worse place kind of for everybody across the board for no real benefit to anybody.
Well, you covered a lot of ground. There are a couple things that you touched on that I do want to respond to because it does personally interest me.
Sure.
You talked about how, like, you know, tournaments might pull out of the state because of the new law. I happen to be a huge basketball fan.
Yeah.
I'm going to the Final Four later this month. I love it when the NCAA comes here and plays those opening round games in Des Moines. I would hate to see them pull out of Des Moines.
Yeah.
But if they did that, like, you know, like the All-Star games have pulled out of places because of laws like
sure.
this, I would fully support that because I just think it's the right thing to do.
But, yeah, you bet. I mean, we all got to make – draw our line somewhere, right? Like, and say, well, I'm willing to give that up if if we can get a reasonable policy. And that's, you know, I hope we get something out of the NCAA. I think they've been way too soft on this up until now, but I welcome them to reconsider their stance on that, because it's really not fair if your athletes can't even play in the state that you're holding a competition in. You know, that's tough, because again, this does apply to colleges. It applies to college athletes in the same way. And it also usurps the NCAA's hard work on what they had done. Now they've kind of fiddled with this within the past months or so, and I think have made it substantially worse, because their policy was very much guided by scientific and medical experts up until a couple months ago, when they kind of decided, oh, we're going to do this sport by sport thing and make it more confusing for everybody. The point kind of stands that the governing bodies of these sports had done quite a substantial amount of work to sketch out policies that were both fair and inclusive for these athletes, and yet here comes the legislature saying, well, we know better than you based on the no evidence that we have. and we say that your policy is bad. We evaluate this on no evidence. We have no, you know, scientific medical claims to make, but we've decided that it's bad, and therefore we're going to overrule you. Again, just not a good model of governance.
Sure. The other thing I want to touch on, you mentioned Jeff Shipley's comments.
Yeah.
And I have a wife who's also battling stage 4 cancer, so you can imagine how that made me feel, having a transgender son.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah, I don't need to get into that.
I am decidedly anti-cancer. I know that's a brave statement to make, but.
Well, getting back to the new law, opponents of it had, you know, some limited legal success in fighting such measures, including last year when a federal judge temporarily blocked West Virginia's enforcement of its ban after advocates sued the state. The judge said that he had been provided with scant evidence that this law addresses any problem at all, let alone an important problem, and you touched on that. So do you think there's a chance that opponents of the law could take some legal action to try to block it here?
Yeah, I think there is a chance. I don't know of any, like, active attempts to do that right now, but the other thing to know about legal groups is they don't say anything until they have their case set up, their plaintiff selected, et cetera. They're not going to promise to do something until they know they've got something good. So, you know, we'll wait and see kind of what comes out of the legal realm. But, you know, I'm personally convinced that Bostock and a few other precedents here point to the idea that this is not going to hold up ultimately in court. But again, opponents are putting these cases forward in particular because they are ones that a substantial number of folks in the public and a substantial number of folks in the judiciary are going to find kind of convincing in terms of, well, this just kind of makes intuitive sense to me, right? And so just like they were doing with kind of the cakes, and it was never really about the cake, it was about the kind of the underlying principle, but they're using one of the kind of cases that is not quite as clear in certain people's minds as certain other cases. So, for instance, you know, kind of under the same principle, denying a gay person the ability to rent an apartment. Well, everybody kind of knows that's wrong, and you know, it hits their intuition in a very different way than like the wedding cake case does. But they run under mostly the same area of law, and they hit it. Very similar principles. It's just, you know, people are selecting cases that intuitively feel a different way than the more obvious cases. And for transgender rights, again, the more obvious cases are the medical care stuff, stuff around inclusion in schools and things like that. Most of the public is not okay with those kinds of things because, again, it's the intuition in a slightly different way. But the principles are very, very similar. And if you kind of boil it down, ultimately, I think if you're consistent, you kind of get to the same place. But that's why they're using these more marginal cases is because it hits people and the intuition just a little bit differently, and it's easier for them to get a judge to agree to that discrimination because the judge doesn't see it as discriminatory in the same way as they would see something that's a little bit more obvious. So it is intentional in a number of different ways, and that's one of the ways is this kind of baiting people into taking legal cases before judges who may or may not really understand what the issues are at the core of this, and for good reason. So, like with the cake case, there's just kind of different principles underlying that. But with the trans sports stuff, what we're really talking about when we're talking about things like competitive advantage and stuff like that are really, really complex medical issues that most folks just do not have the capacity to evaluate. I don't even have the capacity to evaluate them because I don't have a medical degree, right? We're really talking about folks who need expertise in specific areas, endocrinology, sports medicine, things like that. And judges are not experts in that. And you know, legislators certainly are not experts in that. Members of the general public are not experts in that. And that's why their arguments are sometimes a lot more successful, because it's harder to evaluate those claims and know what the good evidence is versus just doing, you know, what I maybe derisively called the Google Scholar search and just picking the first thing that agrees with your viewpoint that seems like it's got an air of sciencey stuff to it. You know, and that's why I personally shy away from making those kinds of medical arguments, because I'm not qualified to make them, right? I leave that to the endocrinologists, to the doctors, who, again, we brought in to testify, and they were
all on one very specific side, and it wasn't the side of discrimination. So I think in the cases where this gets so complicated that it needs a medical degree to be understood, we need to leave it to the folks who are equipped to evaluate those arguments in that way, because the folks that are evaluating this right now are unfortunately ill-equipped to do it, and that's why we're getting some of the decisions that we're getting in legislative and legal contexts. So I guess my wrap-up there is just, there is a lot of distrust of medical professionals right now for various reasons, but I would encourage folks to kind of value their expertise and the time that they've spent studying these issues, and actually seek out folks who can evaluate these things. And that's not pundits, it's not people that are talking heads, etc. Generally, what you're going to get when you talk to those folks is a lot of nuance. They're not going to give you a very black and white answer to that question. If you're getting a black and white answer, you're probably talking to the wrong person. I hope that legal professionals are utilizing that kind of expertise. I know I heard it. I was listening to the TRO hearing in Texas on Friday, and they had brought in a substantial number of medical professionals, and ultimately the judge agreed with the medical professionals. And I hope that is what judges across the country do, very, very consistently, because if they do that, I think we'll be in a much better position. But you can't always predict what's going to happen once a case gets started. Sometimes you get the wrong judge and they just don't have the ability to fairly evaluate that kind of evidence, and it goes off the rails. So I always get a little dicey to kind of promising legal outcomes, but I think both the legal principles at the core of it and the evidence are substantial enough that if you took it to a fair judge, we would win. But it's hard to predict.
Sure, sure. Well, Keen, I'm going to let you go with this one final question. I tried to get some information from the Girls Union about how this new law will be enforced, but I was unsuccessful in getting a response from them. I mean, if you have school districts tweeting their support for the LGBTQ community, I don't think it's far-fetched to think that there could be some transgender girls out there, who might be permitted to compete in a girls' sport in defiance of the new law. Mm-hmm. And I'd be curious to know, how this is going to be policed, and what would the penalty be for ignoring the new law? Do you penalize the school district, the administrators, the AD, the coach? I just don't see how they're going to enforce this.
Yeah, I think that is actually maybe the biggest open question right now, is how school districts are not just going to enforce it, but how they're going to interpret it, because there's a lot of pieces of the law that are pretty vague in terms of what can be considered. It says, for instance, and I'm trying to remember this without actually looking at it, so don't quote me verbatim, but one of the pieces about how to determine biological sex is it says, you may rely on the birth certificate issued at the time of birth, et cetera. But it just says may. It doesn't say shall, right? Like, there's a very big difference when we're picking apart a law in terms of how you interpret that and what those words mean. And may means something very different than shall. May means this is one option,
right,
of how you could verify it, and maybe there's others. And so school districts may find some way to interpret that doesn't necessarily match the intent of the legislators who are putting it together, but may be a legally viable way to interpret it. And I don't know of any examples of school districts that are doing that or anything. I'm just kind of ballparking in terms of how I've read the law and what I think it says, and where there are vagaries that might be interpreted in different ways by different people, not in bad faith either, in totally good faith efforts to comply with the law. They're looking at it and saying, well, legally it says may, so I'm gonna do X, Y, or Z, right? And so that is probably the biggest open question in all of this, is how it's going to be interpreted, what school districts are actually going to do with that information. In terms of how it's enforced, there are, for instance, private causes of action in there, so individuals could sue school officials or school districts, etc., if they believe that they've been harmed in some way by this, like somebody doesn't get a position on a team or something and says, well, it's because this kid is trans, and they're going to have to provide some evidence for that, which might be hard for them to do, because
maybe that kid actually isn't trans. I mean, it's going to get really confusing really quickly, right? Unless people have copies of this student's birth certificate somehow, which I don't know how they would muster that. In fact, I hope they don't, because that's a really weird invasion of privacy. It's going to be very confusing, and it's going to lead to litigation across the board. And one of the other bad parts that we haven't really touched on yet is that the Attorney General is actually required to defend any and all actions against school districts who are enforcing this in the way that they think it should be interpreted. So all of these likely very expensive cases are going to then be put on the taxpayer dime so that everybody gets to pay for this mistaken policy.
Well, Keenan, you've been a wealth of information tonight. I really appreciate your time. Our mutual friend, Amber Gustafson, referred me to you, and so I appreciate that referral from her. I've really enjoyed the conversation, so thanks a lot for coming in tonight.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You bet.